Hello, I'm Mark Youngerblood from Pilch Connect, an independent not-for-profit specialist legal service for community organisations. We're discussing the changes and clarifications introduced by the new Associations Incorporation Reform Act 2012. We'll be calling it the New Act throughout this Pilchcast. It is expected that the new Act will commence operation by 1 December 2012, but it could be brought into force earlier. This Pilchcast is intended as an introduction to the new Act for legal practitioners and advisors to community associations. If you are a member of an association or a volunteer and simply have an interest in the changes, then you may also find the discussion valuable. But please be aware that we have produced this recording primarily for lawyers. In this part, we will discuss how the new Act treats key people in the association. Joining me to discuss these issues is Nathan McDonald, who's the Manager for Advice with Pilch Connect. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Mark.
Let's first consider a question that we've received about the definition of office holder. This is an email that Robert has sent us. He founded an incorporated association that provides sports programs to disadvantaged kids called Kick a Goal Incorporated. Now, he hasn't been on the management committee for about 4 years, but it's rare that the association makes a major decision without consulting him first. He often goes to the committee meetings, he gives his opinion on the direction of the association. He wants to know whether he can be held accountable for the way that Kick a Goal Incorporated is managed. Nathan, perhaps it's good to start with the definition of office holder, which I understand is new in the new Act.
That's right, Mark. So one of the key changes that will be included in the upcoming reforms is a definition of office holder, which wasn't presently in the Association Incorporation Act. This definition will not only include the members of the committee of the incorporated association, but will also extend to, for example, the secretary, and importantly, individuals that may not be on the committee but have the ability to influence the strategic direction and influence the organisation. So in particular, senior executive staff might be within this definition, and possibly individuals that are behind the scenes but are deferred to by the committee on a regular basis.
Nathan, does this change the position at common law?
We don't think it does change. I think these definitions have always recognised that there might be individuals that might not formally be on a committee of management that that do have duties to the organisation because they are trusted and have a influential role in the direction of the organisation.
So if we consider the case of Robert, who founded an association, is not on the management committee but is often deferred to in key decisions, it sounds like there's a very real possibility that he may be considered to be an office holder under the new Act.
I think that's certainly the case, and the reforms, I think, go some way to clarifying that Robert would, in this situation, be considered to be a almost a de facto committee member and would fall within this definition of office holder.
Nathan, you mentioned that duties that attach to office holders under the new Act, I think most of our listeners would be familiar with fiduciary duties and duties that have existed at common law. How does the new Act treat legal duties of office holders?
One of the key changes that are included in these reforms is really a codification of those legal duties that are owed to the organisation by office holders. Now, we would argue that these duties have already applied due to that fiduciary relationship that you'd mentioned. But these reforms really go some way to codifying and writing down what those duties actually are and aligning them with what the Corporations Act says in relation to the for-profit sector. The four main duties that we're focusing on contained in the reforms, the first one is a clarification of the existing duty not to make an improper use of information or position. These reforms move away from an idea of office holders gaining directly or indirectly pecuniary or material advantage from their position, and it's changing it to gaining an advantage. So it's, a broadening of how information or position can be used. The second duty is an introduction of a legislative duty to exercise powers and discharge duties with reasonable care and diligence, and that reflects what currently exists in the Corporations Act. Similarly, there's an introduction of a legislative duty to exercise powers and discharge duties in good faith and for a proper purpose. And finally, there's the introduction of a legislative duty to prevent the association from trading whilst it's insolvent. And as we know from the commercial sector, insolvency has a very technical definition, and this particular duty is a direct result of the Associations Incorporation Act cross-referring to the Corporations Act.
Okay. I'm assuming then if the new Act has brought these legal duties on office holders largely into line with the Corporations Act, that there would be some defences available to office holders that might otherwise breach these duties. Is that correct?
That's right. So in addition to applying a lot of these duties and codifying what's already in the Corporations Act, some of those same defences that we find in the Corporations Act have also been included into these new reforms. In particular, I think probably the most noteworthy one is the introduction of a business judgment rule. Those lawyers out there that have done work in the for-profit sector would be well aware of this defence. It's a defence to an alleged breach of their duty to exercise powers and discharge duties with a reasonable care and diligence only. So importantly, it only attaches to that particular duty. But similar to the Corporations Act, that defence is available where an office holder has made a judgment in good faith and for a proper purpose, where they have no material personal interest in the matter being decided, where they've appropriately informed themselves about the subject matter of the judgment and rationally believed at the time that the judgment would be in the best interests of the organisation. So that defence is really, I guess, summarising the legal position that with the benefit of hindsight, decisions that have been made by an office holder that have been informed are not going to be second-guessed. The second key defence that the reforms are introducing is a reasonable reliance on information or advice defence. Now, this is a general defence applicable to all of the legal duties owed by office holders. It's applicable in circumstances where an office holder has placed reliance in good faith on information or advice provided to them. They've made an independent assessment of that information or advice, and the reliance is reasonable where the information or advice was received from either a competent employee, a professional advisor, another office holder, or a subcommittee. And then the final defence that is included in these reforms is a very broad, if you like, ought to fairly be excused defence. And this is a general defence available due to the application of the Corporations Act again. And it's available where, notwithstanding there might be a prima facie duty, a breach of a duty, the court is satisfied that the office holder has acted honestly and ought fairly be excused from partial or whole liability.
Does a breach of each of the four duties you've spoken about attract the same penalty?
There's slightly different penalties attached to breaches of these duties. So the reforms will implement civil fines for office holders found to have breached their duties of up to $20,000. It can also include criminal convictions in certain circumstances and in some cases even imprisonment. But I stress the point that those last two really are reserved for situations where there's a significant fraud or gross negligence.
And we've spoken briefly about the application of the corporations legislation to incorporated associations. Would you mind just summarising for our listeners the key parts of the Corporations Act that will apply to the new Act?
Sure. So the Corporations Act is relied on quite heavily in these reforms. And as we said earlier, unfortunately, it's going to be a case of a lot of associations will need to be familiar with a few clauses of the Corporations Act in order to make sense of these reforms, in particular around the civil penalty provisions that are included in the changes. With regard to breaches of the office holder duties, they're all measured with reference to the Corporations Act. And as we previously mentioned, the introduction of a prohibition on trading whilst insolvent is directly relevant because of the application of the corporations law.
Okay, Nathan, well, we have another email here which asks us to consider conflicts of interest, and I guess you might say that a duty to avoid conflicts of interest becomes an indirect duty under the new Act. But let's have a listen to what Angelique has to say and see if we can answer her query. She's the chairwoman of Coast to Coast Incorporated, which is an association that promotes the health of Victoria's coastal environments. Now, an item for discussion and voting on at the next committee meeting is the appointment of a new executive director. Angelique's brother has been shortlisted for the role. Now, Angelique is convinced that because this does not involve a pecuniary interest, there is no conflict and she can discuss and vote on the issue. Nathan, would she be correct in that assumption under the new Act?
Yeah, well, interestingly for Angelique, the reforms will actually be changing the way in which conflicts of interest ought to be managed and identified by incorporated associations. I guess the starting point will be to point out that the conflict of interest provisions in the reforms will apply to committee members only. And whilst there are already conflict of interest procedures in the current Association Incorporation Act, there will be some slight changes with these reforms. Perhaps the most relevant for Angelique in this instance would be the term pecuniary interest, which is in the current law, is replaced by material personal interest. Now, this makes it a much broader category for office holders or committee members that are trying to work out whether or not they have a conflict. In particular, it takes away this idea that it's only those financial interests that might be included, and it will extend to non-financial personal interests.
So in Angelique's case, where her brother is up for appointment potentially to the position of executive director, would you think that that would be a significant enough interest to qualify as a material personal interest?
I think there's a strong argument to suggest that that's the case. And in any event, I think the perception that's associated with a sibling going for a senior management role, it's probably better to err on the side of calling it a conflict of interest and then managing it appropriately. Under the current law, committee members that do or have identified a conflict of interest might still be able to participate in discussions around the issue, but they can't vote on them. Under these new changes, that's slightly changed, and committee members must in fact leave the room and not participate in discussion around a particular issue in which they have a conflict in, and again, they can't vote on the issue.
Okay. I understand that an association is required to indemnify an office holder under the new Act.
That's right. So one of the other key changes that has raised a bit of interest within the sector is an inclusion of a requirement that incorporated associations indemnify an office holder for any loss or liability that they've incurred in good faith on behalf of the association in the course of performing his or her duties.
Well, Nathan, thank you. There's obviously, it seems, some clarification and some consistency that's coming into the new Act around office holders and the duties that apply to them. Thanks for your time in talking us through some of the more significant points.
Thanks, Mark.
We hope that this discussion has given you an insight into some of the key changes and clarifications being brought in by the new Act. Now, it's time for a disclaimer. It's important to mention that the information we've discussed is not intended to be legal advice, and if you have any specific legal concerns or queries about the new Act, then you should talk to a lawyer before you make a decision about what to do. That is, of course, if you're not a lawyer already. This material has been presented for advisors and organisations affected by the laws in Victoria only. And if you need more information, visit Pilch Connect website at www.pilch.org.au. Thank you very much for listening.